1 Thessalonians 5, verses 12 through 15 will be the focus of our attention today. Paul has addressed the issue of concern that the church had regarding the return of Christ. They had wrong information, either deliberately or unintentionally. There's no way for us to know that. What we do know is that the church in Thessalonica was under the mistaken belief that if you die before Jesus comes back, then you don't get to go to heaven. You don't get to be with Jesus. So Paul wrote to them and said, concerning those who have fallen asleep, and then he goes on to tell us that when Jesus comes again, all are going to be with him. Now, he is not addressing in Thessalonians the broader issues of the second coming. That's why I haven't addressed them, nor do I intend to. That is not the point of 1 Thessalonians. It is a reminder to them that they're in the midst of persecution and oppression and hardship. And what he is saying to them is that Jesus is going to come again, and his victory will be final and complete. His judgment of evil and sin will eradicate it, and those who belong to him will forever be with him. Now, all of the other details that are relative to that, and there are many, and the Bible certainly addresses them, can be studied at another time in a different way. That is not the message of Thessalonians. The message of Thessalonians is, how do we stand firm in the midst of a culture that wants to kill us because we believe in Jesus? That's really the message. And you say, well, that doesn't apply to us here because we don't face those kinds of issues. That is not at all the case. In fact, the reality is that we are seeing an increasing opposition to the Christian worldview. And I think that it is reasonable to expect that that is going to continue to grow. I know that many times we say, well, what we need is a revival, and that we'll see a sweeping movement of God across the land and the land will turn back. Here's the reality, folks. America, while it has always identified itself as a Christian nation, is not a Christian nation, hasn't probably been one for a really long time, or it would not have stopped being one in the first place. Any more than you would surrender your faith. So what is the message? The message is that Christians in every age, until Jesus comes again, are going to find themselves in opposition to the culture that they're a part of. There is an offense of the gospel that is undeniable and will always be present, and it will always have its impact. The Bible says that the word of God goes forth and does not return void. What does that mean? That means those who respond to it are going to be redeemed by it, and those who reject it are going to be judged in it. But there's no in between. There's no middle ground. If the gospel is presented as it is supposed to be, then it's always going to either have the effect of redemption or conviction, but nothing in between. There is no indifference to the gospel. There's no way for us to simply dismiss the reality of the consequences of what God has called us to. So how do we stand firm in the midst of that? How do we continue to be faithful? How do we effectively live and lead as God has called us? That is the message of Thessalonians. And that's what he is directing our attention to today in a very specific way with regard to how we are to live over the time, or during the time, until Jesus comes again. So we see today the church serving. We're going to see the church serving. We're going to see the church believing. We're going to see the church trusting. Several different emphases as we conclude our study in 1 Thessalonians. But in this study, in verses 12 through 15, the focus of attention is on the church serving others and those within the body. So first of all, he says in verses 12 and 13, we ask you, brothers, to respect those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you. and to esteem them very highly in love because of their work, and then be at peace among yourselves. This is a church that's new. It is a church where Paul has appointed elders. Elders, for the sake of our understanding, would be the same position as that which I hold, pastors. And so he has appointed leaders. These elders, these pastors, are now training and teaching other leaders who are going to do likewise. They are going to train and teach others. And it's going to spread and continue to go outward so that more and more people are going to be a part of the ministry and more people are going to be reached with the gospel. This is exactly what we see here. So we have pastors, Craig and Brad, myself, we serve as pastors of this church. We are the leaders of this church. Leadership is not something that is to be apologized for. Leadership is not something that is to shrink back from. This is not a democratic process. Though we oftentimes present the church in that way, there's nothing biblical about that. The church was always guided by leaders, by elders, by pastors. In addition to that, the ministry spread into other areas of leadership. Deacon ministry was solely set apart for the focus of ministry to those within the congregation. So we see it from the beginning in the book of Acts, and we see it repeated throughout, that those men are going to serve with the distinction of reaching out and meeting the needs of the congregation. Again, very biblical pattern. Leaders are also going to be represented by gift groups. So if you read the book of Romans, if you read 1 Corinthians, you will see a variety and a plurality of spiritual gifts that are expressed. Many of them will be through particular leaders. The one that we are most familiar with is the gift of teaching or the gift of pastoring, again, shepherding. So you say, well, that's your job. It is my job. It is part of what God has called me to. But everyone who leads one of our small groups is also shepherding that group, along with the deacons that are assigned to that group, along with the membership that's within that group. So what is the attitude to be with regard to these leaders and to the leadership that they afford? That's what he's describing here. When the church follows those who God has appointed and those who are leading according to biblical teaching and according to gospel-centered ministry, then the only response of the church is to obediently follow God in following those leaders. The result of that is seen in verse 13. Be at peace among yourselves. When this doesn't happen, then what we have is a lack of peace. We have dissension and we have disorder. And churches are well known. Evangelical churches of every stripe are well known for their fighting, infighting, arguing, etc. I'm serving with the Missouri Baptist Convention right now as a member of the Credentials Committee. Sounds important, doesn't it? The Credentials Committee is responsible for admitting or recommending for admittance new churches. So church plants, church starts, and in some cases, church splits. We're also responsible for churches that are cooperating. Do you know how you're a cooperating church within the Missouri Baptist Convention? There are several things. One, you must be in agreement with the Baptist faith and message. Two, your doctrinal view and your participation must be consistent with what we see across the bylaws and all of the other governing documents of the Southern Baptist Convention. But three, you must also participate in the cooperative program. That means giving. Now, we give a lot of money to the cooperative program. This church consistently ranks. Out of over 2,000 churches in Missouri, you always rank in the top 100, usually in the top 50 in total gifts to the cooperative program. As a member of the Credentials Committee, my responsibility then is to vet and then recommend to the convention that will meet in October the admittance or readmittance of churches that have either been not cooperating but now are, or to recommend removal of churches that are no longer cooperating, either because they don't give to the cooperative program or because they have veered from the doctrinal teachings that we hold dear. It's a very uncomfortable, confrontational committee to be on. And when I said yes to it, I hadn't thought it through. But getting to make all these phone calls and talking to different churches around our state and pastors and church members and so forth, what I find is that many times churches are born out of conflict. Let me tell you something. While it is certainly possible that God can redeem that, and God can work that out of a church, it doesn't happen very often. When churches are born out of unresolved conflict, and when churches are born out of things that have more to do with their disagreement with other people than with their embracing and agreement of the gospel message and the biblical message, many times what you see is that conflict continues on, because eventually whoever you were in conflict with in the other place, you will find somebody that will become a part of this place that's going to be in conflict with you too. Peace is going to be resolved when we have godly leadership throughout that remains fixed on a purpose that is greater than any one of us individually. Temple Baptist Church exists for the glory of God through lives transformed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's it. Everything else is secondary. And everything else is not worth fighting over. Leadership. Respect the leaders among you. He says to respect and esteem them and love those who labor, those who lead, those who admonish. I've done a little bit of all of that already this morning. And then he says, be at peace among yourselves. Secondly, look at verse 14. Respond to those in need. We urge you, brothers, admonish the idle, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, and be patient with them all. Admonish the idle. It's hard to know exactly who this is referencing, although there are three occasions. We've already seen one of them in 1 Thessalonians. We'll see the other one very specifically in 2 Thessalonians. But here, it is assumed, because of those two brackets on either side of this statement, that the idle were people that were anticipating the return of Jesus, but so much so in their lifetime that they had stopped working. They weren't going to work, and they weren't doing anything to contribute to others. They weren't taking care of their families. They weren't contributing to the church and its ministry, and they were just sitting. Some of them had become dependent on the generosity of wealthier members of the church, and now they were content to simply live out their lives until Jesus comes, waiting for those members to continue to provide for their daily needs. Paul addresses this and says, don't be idle. Get to work. Get a job. Contribute. Take care of your own and help others. He's being very practical in this. I think a lot of times we have the notion that there is something other than work that we are to be a part of. Remember what happened when God made Adam? He made man and he put him in the garden to do what? To work it. The difference is that when he did that, and when he had dominion over it and all of the creation that God had made and brought to him, it didn't produce thistles and thorns and ragweed and junk. It just produced fruit. Sin came in, and then right after that, the chemical company started developing ways to kill the bugs and the weeds. Work is a natural part of who we are. It's something that God made us for. Lives that are productive and contributing. Being idle, even idleness that is due to something that you have deemed to be a good thing, is still wrong. I think that Christians, if you want to be as faithful to the testimony by which you've been called and transformed, is you need to be busy, you need to be at work when Jesus comes back. He needs to find us about the business to which God has called each of us. Whether it's caring for families, whether it's doing the job that you've been given, whether it's serving in the church, whether it's ministering in the world, doesn't make any difference. All the above, the reality is we need to be about that which we are capable. I realize that the time comes when physically we're not able to do the things that we used to do. But there are other things that we take on. There are other ways for us to remain active and our minds to remain active. I talked to my dad yesterday and I said, "How you doing?" He said, "I'm doing good." My dad's 82 years old and he's still serving on a church staff. He said, "It's been a busy week." He said, "I did the largest funeral I've ever done." And I thought, well, that's saying something, because this is a man who's been doing funerals for many decades now. He said, "I did that one on Monday," and then he said, "Then I had another one on Friday, because the pastor's wife went into labor and had a baby, and the baby had some complications, and then the wife had to go back to the hospital because she had some complications. So I'm preaching tomorrow and I'm getting ready for that, and I stepped in and did the funeral." I said, "Dad, you sound awful busy." "Oh," he said, "I am. Can't catch my breath." I believe what he said was, "I'm catching them faster than I can string them." You got that one? You wrote that one down already. Kathy keeps a list of his sayings. We're going to make a book when he dies. The sayings of Gerald Sr. I like that. I like that he's busy. I like that he's using the gifts and abilities that he still has. I like that he's saying, "Hey, get me some tickets to a Cardinal game. I'm going to come up and we're going to go to a game." I like that. I want to be like that. And you, do you know how long I had to live to get to the place where I could say I want to be like my dad? I mean, from like 14 on, no, I don't want to be like my dad. And now it's like, oh no, he's not bad after all, you know. 40, 50 years, you figure it out. He's been the same. I'm just slow. God has called us to be busy about the work to which he has given us. Admonish the idle, he said, and get them back into the workforce. Get them back to doing the things to which God has equipped and called them to. Encourage the faint-hearted. The faint-hearted is another phrase for weak, and it means that they are weak because of some sort of external or internal influence. So whatever it is that has produced this weakness in the person, he's saying, encourage them. And so what is the response of the church for those who go through periods of weakness? It is to come alongside. That's what encourage means to do. We come alongside, we offer support, we lift up, and we're to be busy about the ways of helping one another. And so when we encourage the faint hearted, I don't know of anything better than what I see in our Love Thy Neighbor campaign. We had to cancel the project day yesterday. Bradley was really, really sick from the middle of the week up to really until yesterday. And as you could see this morning, he's much better. But he was the one leading that. And so our other projects we put on hold, but we've only rescheduled them. We're going to do them. I love to see that. But one of the projects still went forward yesterday because Matt Monti and a group of guys with him were going to take care of that anyway. And they did that project. It's helping people. It's being a part of ministering and serving. And those who maybe haven't got the strength at that moment to do whatever it is that needs to be done, we come alongside. And it can apply in so many different ways. He says that we are to not only help the weak, encourage the faint-hearted, but then he says, be patient with them all. So ministering to people in various circumstances or states of need, whether it's weakness or whether it's fear and faint-heartedness or whether it's idleness and a misunderstanding of the direction and leadership that God has called us, what he says, we don't throw anybody away, but we try to come along and work together to keep everyone on the same track. What is that track? That track is declaring the gospel. It is teaching and sharing Jesus. It is helping the world to see Christ through the lives that he has called each of us to live. In verse 15, then, he says, "See that no one repays anyone evil for evil, but always seek to do good to one another and to everyone." Here is a principle that you need to put in your permanent vault. Permanent vault. Evil is never to be the tool of the believer. Evil is never to be the tool of the believer. When we figure out a way to make evil okay, then what we've done is we have shifted from a biblical worldview to one that is more circumstantial. My values now are dependent on the circumstances in which I find myself. That way I can adjust them. What that means is you have no values at all. Because values, by definition, are non-negotiable. They are principles upon which we cannot compromise. One of the most interesting scenarios that I see played out over and over again in television and movies is a scenario in which the bad guys take a loved one of the good guys, and then they threaten the good guys and they say, "Unless you do this, then we're going to kill your loved one, or we're going to torture them," or something. There was a whole show based off of it, I think last season for a while. It didn't make it. But the whole concept was based on children being taken whose parents were all diplomats and governmental leaders. And these governmental leaders were told, "Unless you do what we tell you, then we're going to kill or harm your child." I understand the intensity of that. I do. As much as I could, not being in the situation. But what they were making these people do, and what they were doing, was killing other people. And I think that's the most ridiculous thing imaginable. I mean, would you really kill somebody else to protect someone that you love? An innocent? I wouldn't. I told Kathy, I said, "If they take you, I'm sorry, I'm not going to kill somebody else." And I said, "And please," I'm thinking to myself, "There's no way she would do that, but please don't ever do that for me." That's not possible. You can't do that. Evil is never the tool of the believer. God has called us not to repay evil for evil. That only speaks of revenge. It only speaks of an attitude by which we adopt the principles of that which we abhor. It simply cannot be. I realize that it will eliminate us from certain things. I realize that it will mean maybe a lack of success in a particular area, in a culture that is so driven by evil. But the reality is that unless you hold fast the values and principles that are yours through Christ, there is no sacrifice. And there is no righteousness. God has called us to be light and salt in the world. And we can't do that by constantly massaging the truth to get it to fit into some little crevice where it doesn't belong. Or massaging evil and dressing it up. You can put lipstick on a pig, it's still a pig. You cannot take evil and make it the tool of the believer. He says, "Do not repay evil with more evil." On the other hand, he says that we are to always seek to do good to one another and to everyone. So rather than evil, we're to do good. What defines good? Defining good doesn't always mean doing what someone else wants. Think about it. You walk through you could go there right now. You could go to Walmart right now. I guarantee you there will be somebody there that has a small child, and that child is asking for things off of shelves that they do not need and they cannot have. And when they don't get it, they're going to be angry about it. I think the phrase that my grandchildren use is, "That's not fair." I hear that occasionally. You might as well go ahead and learn life's just not fair, if that's your definition of it, you know. Doing good doesn't always mean doing what somebody else wants. The word good here is a word that helps us to understand what is right, what is best. It is a distinction between things that are good and things that are best. And it is drawing that distinction. And so we are to do good. We are to do that which truly benefits, that which truly helps another. It may not always be what that other person wants, but it is nonetheless the right thing to do, in the same way that parents do what is best and right for their children, even if the children don't know otherwise. We are to be about the things that are good, which means they aren't defined by the society that we're a part of, the culture that we're a part of, or even what we dream up in our own minds. Goodness has to be defined by the biblical record. And so we look to God to know that which is good and that which is best. And then we let the Spirit lead us in a way so that we can be intentional in doing good to others. So rather than repaying evil with more evil, falling into this continuing downward spiral of revenge and sinfulness, we now get to do good for those even who do evil. He says, do good to others. He's referring to the membership of the church. He's talking about those who are part of the body. But then he also says, and to everyone. And this is where it gets tough. Doing good to everyone is going to take a really healthy perspective of forgiveness. It's going to require a really strong sense of focused faith. It's not easy. It is necessary. This may, in fact, be the highest form of testimony that the Christian can offer a world that is so steeped in itself. Because here is where we can stand firm in that which we believe most, knowing that Jesus is coming. He is our reward. He is going to be enough. Gives us the ability to surrender whatever is necessary in this life, but also to be obedient, recognizing that declaring Him, not only with what we say, but what we do, is the highest we can hope to achieve. Now, did all of them, as they were receiving this word from the apostle in this letter, did all of them receive it? Did they all understand it? Did they all apply it? No, I'm sure they didn't. I'm sure that this would have been somewhat overwhelming, but keep in mind the context. These people are being persecuted. They are oppressed. Many of them have lost their jobs. Some of them have lost family, and they are isolated now because of their faith in Jesus Christ. These are conditions that exist today throughout the world. In fact, you and I live in a place that is one of the few where those conditions don't exist. So that what they were experiencing, what they were being told, and what they were facing every single day, Paul wrote to them to say, here's how you stand firm. And here's the situation and circumstance in which you are faced with that, but you do it anyway. It is something that adds weight and significance and authority to the faith of these believers. It removes from them the specter of immaturity, and it takes away the whole concept of merely being a cultural Christian because that's what the other people I'm close to are doing. And it drives home with depth and sincerity and faith the essential nature of trusting Jesus no matter what and living for Jesus in all circumstances. The church serving, then, isn't always going to be easy. It isn't always going to be cheap. It isn't always going to be comfortable. But it is always going to be necessary. And until Jesus comes, He has assured us there will always be those who will stand firm for that truth.